Hello, this is Scott Wells for the Magic Word Podcast. And today I have as my guest, author John Gaspard. Hey there, John. How are you?
I'm good, Scott. How are you doing?
I'm doing just great, thank you. And you're living in Minneapolis, actually? Or in
Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Okay. What's the population? Is it about 500,000, about 500,000 or so? What is that?
Oh, boy. I think when you add in the suburbs, it gets close to a million when you get way out there, because we also count St. Paul, because we are just across the river from each other.
Of course. I guess Twin Cities, kind of.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty jumping.
Right. Well, the reason I wanted to mention that is because that's going to tie in later to some of what I want to talk with you about. And, of course, what I want to discuss is the, I think, a fabulous book, which I highly recommend, The Ambitious Card, which sounded like an ambitious project, I imagine, when you first got started.
I had no idea.
Now, did you just have an idea, first of all, like of a short story, or had you written something before, or how did this actually come about?
Well, I've been writing, I've been making low-budget movies since I was a teenager, feature-length. Mm-hmm. So I was not unfamiliar with the writing process and the creating of a story. And I had done an earlier novel about a modern-day Jack the Ripper that kind of taught me a little bit about how to attack that process. And then I just had this idea that it would be fun to do what will end up being a series of mysteries about a real-life magician who in real life in the sense that he's fictional, but he's a real magician. Mm-hmm. And he makes his living as a magician and occasionally stumbles into murders, kind of like Murder, She Wrote, but with a magician.
Right. I like the concept. Let me back up. I love the concept and the book. I think it is a very good read. And I do want to get into that. You were talking about, though, making movies, low-budget movies and everything like that, and being a screenwriter, and I would certainly think is different than being an author. I mean, there's a lot of different types of things you have as a screenwriter as far as the blocking and everything else that you're writing in, which is different when you're writing a book.
It is, but it all comes down to telling a story about a character.
Mm-hmm.
And my screenplays were always maybe a little too dialogue-driven, which isn't great for a screenplay, but works out well in a novel.
Sure.
And the concept, you know, everything in a movie is broken down into scenes. And books are exactly the same way. When do you start the scene? When do you end the scene? How much information do you deliver in the scene? It's really the same thing. It's just a question of filling it out enough so that the reader can imagine the scene without giving them so much information that they're completely bored to tears.
Yes. I can imagine what you're saying then, when there's too much dialogue and none of visual, that for a movie that people are going to get kind of tired of just listening and trying.
Yeah, unless it's really, really, really great dialogue.
Right, exactly. Yep. You have to be really invested in the character and everything. Exactly. And this book then, again, follows a magician who performs in and around the Minneapolis area.
Right. His name's Eli Marks, and he's in his mid-30s. He's recently divorced. And because of the divorce, he needed a place to live, and so he's gone back to live above his uncle's magic store. His uncle, Harry Marks, is an old-time magician who runs a magic store in South Minneapolis. And he sort of raised Eli. Eli's parents died when he was a teenager, and so he's spent the last 20 years living above the magic store. His uncle has an apartment on the second floor and his apartment on the third floor. And so it's kind of a homecoming for him to go back and start living with his uncle again and running the magic shop while going out and doing his various gigs.
And he's still just working in and around the town.
That's
Minneapolis.
Right.
He's really not like a corporate magician where he's out doing a lot of traveling or working cruise ships. And he mostly, since he's got the operation of the magic store day to day, he stays there.
In this particular story, he's only in town, although I do have plans for him to go
traveling
on a cruise ship at some point, because I think that would be interesting.
Yeah.
And a corporate gig at some point. But right now, all his corporate stuff is just in town. And actually, Minneapolis, St. Paul area is a big enough area that you could make your living possibly as a full-time magician. You might have to do a little something else.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are people here who I know do a good job making their living as magicians, but they also travel around a bit as well.
Well, you mentioned that he was a little bit of the backstory when you were describing Eli Marks as being divorced. I think that what you had talked about in this book, it would be interesting in future books to fill in that backstory, you know, talking about his ex-wife, you know, working the DA's office, I guess, and her new husband, who's the detective. You know, it looks like there's kind of a little rub of emotion there.
Yes, that does surface again. I've just finished the first iteration of the next book in the series, which is called The Bullet Catch, and there is more with his ex-wife and a little more discussion about mm-hmm. what it was like being married to a magician.
Well, it sounds like there's kind of a theme going. The next one's The Bullet Catch, and this was The Ambitious Card, so I could see kind of going through these titles,
yes.
I guess, that would...
Each one will be named after... originally, I was going to name them after just what I thought were interesting phrases in the magic world, because there are so many, you know, Hindu shuffle, mm-hmm. all sorts of fascinating.
Yeah, they're colorful. They're colorful.
Very colorful. But then I realized I don't want to be giving away moves in the titles, mm-hmm. so I'm just going to stick with a general trick. The Ambitious Card, in this case, The Bullet Catch, in the next one, without giving anything away, but you can still talk about the trick in some depth without ruining it.
Right. I thought that was something interesting, too, that you really were not discussing secrets, and this isn't, although this is something certainly for the general public, there's not a discussion, an expose of tricks per se, you know, in the book.
Yeah, I really tried to walk that line. You know, it's not a book for magicians. It's a book that magicians, if you like mysteries, you will like it.
Precisely.
But don't like mysteries and you're a magician, you probably wouldn't care about it. But I wanted the general public to enjoy it, but I also didn't want there to be any exposure. And that actually worried me for a while. I wasn't quite sure how I could do that in a book, having a magician perform tricks. And then there was a TV series that I found online called Celebra Cadabra.
Oh, sure.
Which was, I thought, a terrific reality show. I thought everyone did a great job on it. It was really fun. And they did just mm-hmm. the best job of showing people learning how to do magic without showing how the magic is done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That really works. You can give enough of it. And I think you could certainly tell me as a magician, as you read it, everything Eli describes is correct as to how the audience would perceive what he's doing. And everything he's doing is reasonable, something a magician could do. I'm just not telling you how he's doing it.
Right. Yeah, I want to even turn to that excerpt. I was looking over here on page 34 early on, where you were talking about that very thing where he is being interviewed by an NPR person. He's supposed to be busting this psychic. And then he says, well, he's kind of in a dilemma over there. And so then... the person says, well, don't take this in the wrong way, Eli, the host said, getting ready to go in for the kill, but you appear to want it both ways. You say it's all fake and not real, but at the same time, you won't explain how it's done. That doesn't seem quite fair now, does it? And then he goes on to say, well, maybe I can meet you halfway. And so then they kind of go through a litany of the different tricks that this mentalist had done. And he'll say, well, that was a magic trick, and I can't explain it, but I can duplicate that, or I can kind of – you're really not giving anything away. But the interesting thing is how that is a dilemma, I think, that a lot of magicians are faced with, in which that they say, well, you see the latest David Blaine or Chris Angel special. Do you know how he did that? It's the first thing they say. It's when you're a magician, do you know how he did that? And you really don't want to say, oh, yeah, sure, I do that all the time. You know, it's like, you want to agree with him. That was exciting, wasn't it? I mean, it is a dilemma, I believe, right there, where and you point that out to the beginning. So I think that was very well done.
Well, thank you.
And then as far as developing the rest of the book, the way that the texture of the scenes that I can see and feel and hear and use all my senses, it seems like, you know, to enjoy that. I mean, the first scene there again where they're inside this cave, that was a kind of a main question I had. I assumed then there must all these places must be real places like the cavern that they're discussing here.
You know, most of the locations are real. The Wabashaw Caves have been there forever and ever and ever. I described them pretty accurately. It used to be miles and miles and miles of caverns you could walk through, and they've sort of blocked them off, and now they have, I think, four or five big rooms. And they do events there all the time. They do gangster parties. They do all kinds of parties. They do seance sorts of things there. So that is real. I think just about everything in the book is real except for the magic shop. I created... the magic shop, which I call Chicago Magic, kind of as a nod to Jay Marshall, because Harry Marks is very much like Jay in the sense that he you know, he'd been around forever, and mm-hmm. he'd done everything, and was kind of versed in a lot of different arms of the magical person. You know, he could do ventriloquism, he could do all kinds of different things. So I made up that magic shop. That doesn't exist. I put it right between two places that do exist on 48th in Chicago in South Minneapolis. But everything else, I'm just trying to think back. I don't think I made up any other locations. They're all, if they're not real, they are. Like, there's a record shop, Akashic Records, which is not named that in Minneapolis, but anyone who lives here and reads the description of it will know exactly that it's the Electric Fetus, and it's right off the freeway, and you can't get to it from the freeway. You can see it from the freeway. There's just no way to get to it from the freeway.
That sounded like quite an eclectic place, the record shop there, with all the things that are being sold and incense and everything,
yeah,
but groceries.
The thing I added to it was the back room where they do the aura photography. Everything else is mm-hmm. pretty much exactly in that spot. In fact, if you want to go pick up a really old 33 RPM comedy album like Harry does, they have bins and bins of them.
Wow. Well, again, the detail that you explained each of these places, I thought they that you have a vivid imagination, or it must be real, and you have visited them several times and are very familiar with them. So,
yeah.
Very well done. Well, beyond that, the rest of this I thought was, again, very well done, from the chapter to chapter, you know, kind of like a Dan Brown type of thing. It's like, oh, I really can't put this down. I want to see what's going to be happening next. And with the different murders that were happening. In a way, when you're talking then, John, about the development of this character, and it reminds me a little of Black's Magic, which mm-hmm. was the old television show with Hal Linden.
Hal Linden, yep.
Yeah. And similar kind of a thing, in which he was, well, in this particular case, he was a retired wealthy magician. I mean, imagine David Copperfield, for those people, younger people who may not be familiar with that old TV series. But he was a retired, very successful magician. And then his father was living with him, who was a con man. And then the two of them would do shows, and something would happen. Someone would be murdered or something, and then they would go and help solve that. So I kind of see Eli Marks. Was there any bit of influence, perhaps, by that?
You know, I didn't come across Black's Magic until after I'd finished the first book. And I only made it through about – I bought the set, I think, illegally online. I don't think it's really available for real. And watched about three episodes. And although I certainly love Harry Morgan and Hal Linden, I felt they kind of cheated with the magic,
mm-hmm.
and they did stuff that you really could not do.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wanted to make sure that everything that happened in the book was something that a magician could actually do. When I sent it out originally to try to get it published, there was one publisher who wrote back who said she was very upset that Eli didn't use any of his magical powers at the end to save himself. And I thought, well, you know, I don't want to give anything away here, but he really does use, he's very clever mm-hmm. in what he does to save himself at the end with this, you know, kind of with what's in his pockets.
Yes, exactly.
And it's not really MacGyver. It's just, here's what he's got, and he's able to make it work. And I realize that there's people out there who think that they really have magical powers, and that a magician should be able to magically do anything, which I suppose is great in the sense that, you know, they're open to the delight that a good magic show can present. But on the other hand, I mean, it's reality. He cannot walk through walls.
Well, with the popularity of Harry Potter books mm-hmm. and the movies and everything, perhaps that publisher was thinking the same thing. Oh, well, you know, yeah. This will fly better if actually you find out in the end he does have true magical powers. He's been keeping under wraps.
Yeah, I just couldn't stop that after.
And thank you for keeping true to the magic. You know, it seems like also that when we see, read, or hear about magicians, they usually have some sort of an evil nature about them, or they're the villains or something bad, or they do have some, you know, psychic or bizarre ability of some sort or another. And this just seems like a regular guy who just happens to be kind of in the right, wrong place at the right time, you know, mm-hmm. in order to kind of help work through things. And, you know, he's really not going out and seeking adventure. It just kind of comes his way, and he just has a knack of being able to handle it and work through it.
Well, so far, yes.
In this one, mm-hmm. it seems that he's worked that way.
Well, so, you know, I've known performers all my life. My wife's an actress, and I have several friends who are magicians, which I think most people don't. I mean, I'm not a magician, but most people, an average person, doesn't have more than one friend who's a magician. And I just found that they were so interesting because they have the combination of the persistence of working on something, on the actual craft of it, so that it is invisible and seamless, but they also have the neuroses of a performer. Mm-hmm. And that to me is an interesting combination of someone who is an expert at something. And in some ways, Harry is far more an expert just because he's been doing it for 40 years longer, but who also just has the natural neuroses of getting up on stage and getting in front of an audience and what am I going to do and trying to have a relationship. And it just seemed like an interesting mix that hadn't been done before.
Certainly so. You know, it's interesting you mentioned that too, John, because I was just talking with a friend of mine about OCD, magicians having mm-hmm. OCD, and it seems that many successful magicians have that to a degree, in which yeah. they just are obsessed by something, and you can't go to sleep until you figure this out, or you're working on a new trick or a routine or something. And I think that's due in part to or why they're successful. We are successful, I guess.
I had the great pleasure of going to the Genie convention last summer and seeing more magic in a 3-day period than I've probably seen in my whole life, because you don't really get, even though I have friends who are magicians, I don't watch them perform all the time, and you don't get to see that much magic in real life. And watching these guys over 3 days just do the stuff they did with the level of expertise and the ability to captivate an audience. Granted, it's kind of a captive audience, but you could still get the sense that, you know, when Juan Temeraz walks out on stage, if they don't know who he is, within about 5 minutes, he's going to have an audience in the palm of his hand, because they're consummate performers who have taken the time to get really, really, really good at something.
True, yes. Now, you had mentioned this was your first magic convention, and you touched on something else, the direction I was wanting to go here later, and that is about you not being a magician and the types, the authority with which you write about a magician, but not having that magical background. Your background, again, really is more in film and production and that mm-hmm. kind of a thing. So I know that you have mentioned in the beginning in the dedication about Bill Arnold, who I have not seen for a long number of years. He used to work here in Houston at the Magic Island when it first opened.
Okay.
And so I knew him back in, oh, goodness, what that would have been about 1983, I guess.
Yeah.
And he was here with another gentleman whose name escapes me. And the two of them plus Scott Hollingsworth were the three close-up guys who worked here for the first few years of the Magic Island's operation. And then he'd moved on, and I'm assuming it's the same guy who was Triple Espresso and all
yep,
that?
That's yep. Bill.
Okay.
Yep.
And he's in Minneapolis?
He is. He's just blocks from me right now.
Oh, mercy. Well, be sure and tell him hello for me.
I will do that.
It's been so, so long since I've seen him, and I have always admired his work. And some of the guys around here still talk about stuff he did. He's a very excellent magician. Highly recommend him. Like
yes.
to see him again. And so he was an inspiration, or, you know, you had mentioned that you just knew a few magicians.
I did. He's been a longtime friend of mine. There's a guy named Arden James out of Milwaukee who I've had the pleasure of working with, and he's sort of a magician mime.
And I'm Arden. Mm-hmm.
Arden was going to perform at our wedding and then had a family crisis come up, and his good friend Tina Leonard
sure.
stepped in, so we got to meet Tina, which was just great. The guy who taught Bill Arnold everything he knows, well, most of what he knows as a magician, his name's Steve Carlson. He lives just a block away from me, and we house sit each other's dogs all the time. There's a guy in town named Matt Dunn who's a terrific magician. And then in order to kind of get a bit more of a hands-on feel for it, I took lessons from a magician named Suzanne.
Mm-hmm. I know her,
who,
too.
Who works at the Magic Castle all
right.
the time and is probably more of a traveling magician than Eli Marks.
Is she a Minneapolis person?
She's based in Minneapolis, oh, and okay. she, I think, has a couple restaurant gigs here, but I think mm-hmm. she also does a lot of corporate traveling.
Mm-hmm.
And she and I sat down for probably, a half dozen, two-hour sessions, ostensibly just to walk me through an ambitious card routine, because
mm-hmm.
that was the one I needed. Originally, I was going to, whatever the book title was, whatever the trick was, I was going to learn it and be able to do it. And then the second book ended up being the bullet catch, and I went, well, all right, I'm gonna toss that idea aside. That's not gonna work.
Yeah.
I'm not that stupid. But anyway, Suzanne and I sat down for coffee at a coffee shop here for hours, several times, and she walked me through all the moves. She was a student of Al Schneider's, so she had a way that he had taught her to do stuff, and she would show me, here's what Al would do, and here's what I would do, and here's why, you know, I'd say, how do I do this point? She said, well, let's try a top change. Well, what's that? All right. It's a gutsy move, but I'm going to teach you how to do it, and she would show me how to do that. And I can still do a little bit of it. I mean, if someone puts a deck of cards in my hand, I can make the card that they pick appear at the top and disappear and appear at the top, disappear. I can't do anything more than that. But what I got out of that, besides just the mechanics of holding a deck of cards, was sort of the day-in, day-out life of a magician, because we were just chatting about what she was working on and where she was going when she did. And that was that was huge. And then, of course, knowing Bill Arnold and knowing, you know, having worked with him in corporate settings, because not only is he a good friend of mine, but I've also hired him many times for the job I work at, where we hire for corporate events, and just seeing, you know, that side of it, the backstage side of it. But then the other half of it was I had to learn about psychics, because everyone in the book who's killed is a psychic.
Right, and a mentalism. I was going to ask you about that, because the first guy, Gray, who was killed in the first chapter, that he also was a mentalist. And you go into a lot of detail and things that made me think that not only are you friends with or know something about magic, but you obviously know something about mentalism.
No, I don't. It's all just research. I read Corinda's book.
Sure.
Did a lot of Bob Cassidy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of got a sense of what is a typical, here's kind of stuff that they would do. There's a bit more exposure in the whole mentalism thing in the book than I'd like, but I kind of have to explain that at certain points he's got an earpiece in his ear and someone is feeding him stuff, because that's a plot thing. I had to work out his whole routine, which was essentially just coming up with what would be a 90-minute routine for somebody and then trying to condense it down and explain it.
Mm-hmm. That was very well done. As far as, again, I could picture someone doing that, you know, the different pieces. But it was not just the pieces that were put together, but it was the way that it was scripted, you know, moving from one thing to another. It didn't seem like it was a disjointed act. This is just a sub-plot, you know, part of the whole thing, of course. But I thought that Gray, the character here, probably was very successful if that was the kind of act that he was doing in a 90-minute act, because it tended to have multiple levels of excitement, and it kept moving along. It was the act was scripted well in the background of this, is when you were explaining this. So for someone who hadn't had a mentalist consult on this, I thought it was well done there, too.
Oh, thank you. I think he actually was probably pretty good at what he did. He just wasn't a very nice guy.
Yeah. I thought that was pretty funny. Yeah, the eulogy that his girlfriend was the only one who had something to say, and it wasn't very positive.
No, it wasn't.
There were some parts of the book that certainly caused me to chuckle that I really enjoyed. I didn't feel like that there was – it's one of those things where that there was inside shop talk or something. I mean, this is just the life he led, and this was very matter-of-fact in the way that he would talk and live things, you know.
Yeah, I didn't want to make it too inside baseball. I didn't want it to have – I think there's stuff that magicians will enjoy that the average reader won't, or certain things they'll recognize. For example, in the second book, I have Eli's forced into very quickly doing a routine with the invisible deck. And the way that he describes what he's doing is, you know, commonplace to a normal reader, but a magician will go, oh, I see. Yes, he has to – know what the card is before he opens the backpack, and he has to turn it and all, you know, little things that don't give anything away, but the magicians go, yes, that's how you do it. Mm-hmm. And I did have a couple friends read the book before it went to the publisher, just to make sure, magician friends look at it and make sure that I really hadn't either exposed anything, which apparently I hadn't, and then making sure I got the terms right.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I think we got that covered.
I do. I think you cover that in spades. Have a pun there. Sorry. So, yes, you had dedicated the book, and you included Arden James and Suzanne and Tina Leonard. But then I noticed then in the acknowledgments that you had included Dodd Vickers and Richard Kaufman. You'd mentioned, of course, Richard had sponsored the Genie Convention, which you had attended and learned a lot that time. Yeah. And so what is that kind of what he contributed? And what did Dodd Vickers have to do?
Richard, in addition to everything I learned from Genie and Magic Magazine, Richard was nice enough to print an excerpt from the book in last, I think, September's issue. He ran the first two chapters of the book in Genie, which was a huge help and very, very nice. Dodd's contribution, Dodd was going to try to do something with the book once it came out, which he hasn't had time to do, but his contribution was just his podcast, which was a huge help. All those interviews that he did and the interviews you guys did where you just sat around and talked, hugely helpful just to get a sense of you know, the old-time magicians that he talked to, and then the, what it's like as an everyday magician to, you know, just the thing where the guy comes into the magic store and wants to buy something, and Harry says, you can't buy it because you haven't perfected the thing I sold you last week. I'm sure I got that from something, from one of Dodd's interviews, that, that idea of, yeah, I'm not going to sell you something until you perfect the thing I gave you before.
Right. Yeah. Dodd has contributed so much to the craft of magic, certainly. In fact, in recognition of that, so that way that this doesn't get lost, it's recently been announced that he is going to, or is kind of aligned with the Conjuring Arts Center with Bill Kalush, and they're going to have all of his archives and interviews with magicians not only available on video or rather audio, but it's going to be transcribed into the written word then as well. So it will, you know, be up there as well, which I think is just a great thing. He's contributed so much and was obviously the inspiration and kind of the one who asked me to kind of spin off here the Magic Word and start doing this podcast then as well.
Well, those podcasts were just invaluable. Just to be able to listen to Harry Lorraine talk about, you know, all the different stuff he did. I mean, all of them were just, it's just great. And I've really enjoyed listening to yours. I'm getting kind of caught up on them. I wasn't aware of it, and then it came across a Google search or something, and I've been sort of binging on them lately.
Well, thank you. I have just, in talking with Dodd recently about this, you know, he gets literally tens of thousands of downloads per episode, and, you know, I get tens. And he said, it'll come. It took him a long time. He started, like, in the 90s, and he said, it just takes a while to start building up a listenership for people to be aware of it and everything.
Yep.
So, anyhow, so in going back and writing this, and you said you had been a screenwriter and everything then as well, I know that there are other desktop publishing types of programs as well as Lulu online that you can publish. But did you have a goal necessarily of trying to put this into more people's hands and then have a publisher who can help distribute this on a wider basis? How did you go about trying to find, is it Henley? Is it Henley? Or?
It's Henry Press.
Henry
Press. Mm-hmm. You know, I was certainly not opposed to self-publishing if it came to that, but I wanted to give it every opportunity first. I had a great agent in New York who shopped the book around, and that's where we got the comment from the publisher saying, why doesn't he use magical powers to get himself out of the fix at the end? And my timing is terrible. This is just the worst time in the world to try to publish a new series of books through a big publisher, because publishing is going through so many changes. So although the agent did, I think, a terrific job, nobody bit. And then another agent approached me and said, I like this book, let me try it. And she tried selling it. And again, it's just, you know, unknown author, brand new series of mysteries. Don't think so. So she said, I can't help you anymore on this. And I said, that's fine. And I was reading through a magazine called Mystery Scene Magazine, which is for people who are interested in mysteries. It has tons of reviews and articles and things. And there was a review of a book in which the tone of the book, I don't remember which one it was, but it sounded like a light, fun mystery. And I thought, well, this is the perfect publisher for The Ambitious Card, because if they publish this book, which sounds very light and fun, they'll like my book. So I looked them up, Henry Press. They're fairly new. They only had about a dozen titles out at that time. And I sent them the manuscript thinking, well, we'll see. You know, usually these take months. And somehow mine went to the top of the pile inadvertently. And within 3 days, the publisher emailed back and said, I love this book. Is it still available? And I said, yes. And she said, will there be more? And I said, yes. And she said, great, let's do it. And that was about, I don't know, a year and a half ago. And then they went through a very traditional publishing process, which I really liked. It took them about 9 months to get the book ready to where they were happy with it. They had people, they sent out review copies 3 months ahead of time. I mean, they really handled it very professionally. And so far, it seems to be doing pretty good.
So are you going to be kind of like an Isaac Asimov and just keep churning these things out and out and out and just...
Well, it's, you know, it's hard. it's hard just because mysteries don't come naturally to me, and I want them to be, you know, something where you, at the end you go, oh, yes, that all fits, and there was no trickery involved, and you didn't leave out some major point that made the mystery work. And so it took about a year to write the second one, The Bullet Catch, and that's just going to go into them after the first of the year, and will probably come out sometime in 2014. And I'm just starting the third one, which I think will be called The Trick That Cannot Be Explained. But I got to learn more about that trick before I can do that.
Well, that is a great one. Yeah, Vernon's trick. That is, I've done that a couple of times with success. But it's, you know, you really have to use all of your knowledge. It's one of those things that you are walking a tightrope. And in a way, it's kind of like mentalism, you know, where you're going to be anticipating that someone's going to react or answer in a certain way because of just the way the mentalism, some mentalism tricks work. And the same thing with this, that it's what I call really kind of more like jazz magic in a way.
That's exactly the, in my notes that I've been writing. And I think it's going to be tough for Eli because I think he's gotten a little complacent. And I think he's going to run into someone who's a little bit better than him and who can do that and who
inspires him.
And if jealousy is an inspiration, you bet. So that's the one that I'm starting now.
Interesting.
Reading up on The Bullet Catch was fascinating. I've been to Penn and Teller's show, I think, three times and seen their version of it. And I have no idea how they do it. I don't really care to know. But it just seems like kind of a crazy, difficult trick to do.
Well, you know, about that trick in particular, that the we were talking about mentalism or mentalists earlier. My business partner is Banachek and has been since 1987 when we worked together in a close-up room at the Magic Island here in Houston. Anyhow, that and he had performed The Bullet Catch at one of our Christmas banquets for the magicians. And I, as his partner, I've seen him perform that and many other things several times. And it was just one of those things like, eh, that's okay. It just never really impressed me so much, although that he got good press out of it and was using it. And there's a long backstory about how that he had, you know, given that to Penn and Teller. They came to Houston and just, you know, James Randi had said, hey, we're in Houston. You want to stop by and visit with this guy, Steve Shaw. You know, he used to work with me on this, on the Alpha Project. And so they stopped by and they just kind of started chatting. And as they were talking, I guess one thing came up about The Bullet Catch and said, yeah, we've been wanting to do that for a long time. And he said, well, this is 110% safe. And so they tried it, liked it, been, they put their own touches on it. And of course they, you know, attribute him for doing that. But what I was ultimately going to get to is that later after it had, you know, gotten to be more public domain, or I should say public acceptance, or people had seen it and started talking about it. In fact, we were over, Banachek and I were in England, and I saw in the newspaper where it listed, like, I don't know, the top three or five tricks in the world that people don't know how to do that that are still a secret. You know, I think Hans Moretti's, you know, sword in the cardboard box, you know, a trick was, was one of them. But so was the bullet catch. So, I'd ask Banachek about, I said, you know, I've never asked you about this, and we're best friends. And I said, how do you do that? And he said, you know, Scotty, I can't tell you. I said, oh, man. After all these years. He said, if you would have asked me a few years ago, I'd been glad to have shared that with you. He said, my ethics are such that, you know, this is now property of Penn and Teller. I don't do it. They do it, and it's their thing. And he said, I've crossed it off, and I can't tell anybody. I said, oh, man. So I don't even know.
Oh, well, I don't want to know.
Yeah, it's a great trick.
It is really, really great.
Yeah.
In fact, Steve Cohen just did it on a special last year.
Yes, I saw that on the...
And ended up getting shot, which I thought was a lovely touch.
Didn't he get hit with some flying glass or something?
Yeah, something went into his shoulder.
Bruised him severely?
Yeah.
Something,
Yep, knocked him down. It was... Yeah. Oh, that's a nice touch.
Magic secrets revealed or encoded? Or
something. It was some sort of history thing in which he looked at the floating rope and some other things.
That was an excellent TV show, I thought.
Yeah.
And he's got a very good show there at Chamber Magic in New York. If you ever have a chance, he travels with that from time to time and has brought that to Houston.
You know, my wife and I went to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's My wife is delightful because she really doesn't want to know how anything's done. Mm-hmm. And he did some mentalism stuff where it was so dead on. He's got 50 people in the room, and he essentially touched each one of us in one way or another during the course of the act. And as we were leaving, she said, "Don't tell me how it's done, but how is it done?" And I said, "Here's what I'll tell you. He's just using a lot of different techniques at the same time." Mm-hmm. He's using a lot of techniques, and he's switching stuff up, and he's very clever about it.
Steve Cohen is very clever, and he's got a lot of good ideas, and the way that he overlays so many theories that one thing kind of cancels out the other. So it's like, and then that's what I think a good magician will do, certainly, is you give the audience a different path to follow, and then you cut off that and make it into a dead end. So when they back up and go through another part of the maze, they keep mm-hmm. running into dead ends until there are no other explanations except it must be magic.
Yeah, there's a great quote that I think it's Darwin Ortiz said it. Something, I think that's who said it, about if you get people asking the wrong question, they'll never come up with the right answer. And I think that's what he does so well, mm-hmm. Steve Cohen. I think you're always asking the wrong question.
Right. Right. Well, again, the book, The Ambitious Card, is very good, and it is in paperback and available on e-reader, so you can have it then for your iPad, Kindle, or...
Yep, it's you can go right to the Henry Press site, or it's on Amazon, it's on Barnes & Noble, and it's in any format you want, paperback, Nook, e-book, all those.
And when you say Henry, again, it's H-E-N-E-R-Y Press.com.
Press.com, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm sorry, I interrupt. You started to say what? That it's available in all those formats?
It's available in every ebook format, and it looks pretty good in all of them. Sometimes ebooks get a little wonky looking in these. So far, it looks okay.
Mm-hmm. And that's due to the publisher, because I guess they know what they're doing.
They're doing it right. They seem to be doing a very nice job. And, you know, as I told them, like I said to you earlier, don't expect that every magician in the world is going to want to buy this book, because it really is only going to be of interest to someone who likes mysteries, which is all they publish at Henry. So I said, I think you're going to find a good audience among mystery readers, and a subset of that might be people who are magicians, but I think for a second they thought, oh, wow, every magician will want this. Like, no, they're not going to want it. If you like mysteries and you like magic, absolutely. If you don't normally read mysteries, I don't know. It might be a curiosity to you, but otherwise nothing more than that.
The title of this one is called The Ambitious Card, available through all of those sources. And it's too late to have for Christmas, but it's a good read any time of the year.
You know, Scott, thank you for doing this. I feel like I know you just because having heard you on Dodd's podcast and seeing your videos with Banachek, it's this odd sort of thing. Like, I feel like I know you, but we've actually never met. So it's great to actually talk to you for real.
Oh, well, really, it's my pleasure, and I thank you very much. Yes, I enjoy talking with you and a lot of other people. You know, I'll be going to a magic convention, and as I'm walking down the hall, I'll have someone turn around and say, "I recognize that voice." Or someone
That's
else.
The price of fame.
Yeah. What little fame? It's a small fishbowl. And I recognize that because my wife keeps reminding me of that all the time.
They're good at that, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Well, I think that all the fame that you will be getting here soon with this book, I think, is well-deserved. And that is going to be great. And I look forward to future editions with the Eli Marks Mysteries. So that was John Gaspard, and I appreciate you very much for being on The Magic Word. And so until next time, this is Scotty out.